Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today, bird news with Mark Faraday, science coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. Good morning.
Good morning.
All right, fall migration, is it in full swing or is it just heating up?
Early swing. Approaching mid-swing, yeah.
Because the fall is like, I mean, it's a really good time to see birds that you just don't expect to see.
Yeah, in a lot of ways, it's the best time. It's an awesome time to be on the Cape. The birding potential is super, super high. The weather's good. You can drive. You can pull onto Route 6. It's so many good things about September and October. I love October, too. So fall migration, as I'm always saying, it starts in like really early July when you talk about southbound shorebirds. But, you know, that doesn't seem right. But now it's like it's past Labor Day. There's been a cold front or two. It's felt fall like.
Now we can say fall.
Now it's fall migration. September can be a little quiet on the Cape. October tends to be better. We have stronger cold fronts in October that tend to push more birds our way. Something about September, things sort of slip through quietly or fly over us or just, some of the local birds just slip out of town overnight quietly. You know, like yellow warblers are mostly gone and orchard orioles are gone. They leave at night. Our purple martins are gone now. It was nice. We have a big colony now at Wellfleet Bay, as some other places on the Cape do now. And these are swallows. And it was interesting. The adults left first. You know, I just came back on a Monday, and the adults had left over the weekend, and the young ones kind of hung around. They have a different call, and now they're gone. And so some things are gone, like they're gone. But other things have a more protracted migration period. You know, some of the warblers, we'll be seeing them now into October. Yeah. Ospreys are around and increasingly they'll turn up, you know, to November and even later now.
I've been noticing the nests on Surf Drive, a couple of them there. One little osprey, I'm assuming it's the juvenile osprey that's sitting there because mom and dad seem to be gone.
Right. Yeah, the adults will leave before the chicks, but sometimes there'll be like a dedicated dad who stays behind with the one chick that's not quite getting it. You know, he's not fishing on his own quite yet, and I've gotten calls about that. But for the most part, adults are leaving, and some of the ones you're seeing behind, you can tell by listening to them, they're young. Mm. Some adults are definitely still around, still tending those hard to fledge chicks.
Yeah. 866-999-4626 is our number. Love to know what you're seeing. If you're seeing anything unusual, 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Now, I think the common birds are pretty cool to see. And if you're watching the birds in your yard, which is mostly what I do, maybe you should take a walk down to the beach and check it out. We were on the Vineyard last week, and we're just sitting on the beach in Vineyard Haven on the harbor there, and I was amazed at all the different birds that I probably normally wouldn't quite notice if I didn't have my binoculars and my bird book right there with me.
Yes.
Yes.
If only you knew someone who talked about things like that.
I know, right?
But you could know about it.
But so now I'm not the best at identifying a lot of these shore birds yet, but I think I'm getting better. But so we're watching, the fish jumping and, the birds on the, all right, let's see what kind of birds they are. It seemed to be some terns, right? Would it be terns?
Yeah.
And then I was watching these birds fly by, and my husband said, I think those are gulls. I said, they're definitely not gulls. Shearwaters. That's what it looked like, but I wouldn't know which kind. Yeah. But it wasn't hanging around. There was like two of them that just were kind of flying, and then off they went. I don't know. What would it be?
Shearwaters tend to stay low over the water. They have a very particular way of flying where they're just above the surface and they kind of stiff wings. They flap, flap, glide. You know, they look different than gulls in the way they move through space and kind of use the water.
What would be flying with those terns near those fish that would look sort of like a shearwater? No clue. I should have gotten a picture.
It's a good question. I mean, The flocks over bait right now are going to be common terns and laughing gulls for the most part.
I did see a laughing gull, too, and I was so excited.
And a lot of the laughing gulls are juveniles, and they look totally different than the adults. You think of a laughing gull, it's got a black head and a dark gray back. But the adults lose that black head, and then the juveniles look totally different. They're totally dark at the front with kind of like a pale rump. I have this theory that juvenile laughing gulls evolved to look like Jaegers, which are Jaegers are. Oh,
wow. Oh, Dan is on it this morning.
What's so funny in there?
Laughing gull.
Those are laughing gulls, yes, that's right. It's a great a sound of summer.
Yeah.
And laughing gulls are staging right now, and in big numbers. Some places you'll see big flocks of them, and they leave. They leave for the winter, unlike the bigger gulls. But the young ones have this theory that they evolved to look like Jaegers. Apparently someone else had suggested this in a paper or something somewhere, but Jaegers are big, tough seabirds that come through this time of year and chase terns and small gulls and steal their fish. And the terns and gulls know this and know to avoid Jaegers, or they're afraid of them. And so I think these young laughing gulls, they do the same thing. Laughing gulls try to steal fish from other birds, which is called kleptoparasitism. Talked about that here before. It's a good Scrabble word. I'm sure that opportunity comes up a lot. But so I think by looking like a Jaeger, it helps an inexperienced bird, a juvenile laughing gull, steal fish from other birds, but you would have to do. You would have to test that.
All right. Here's the other thing. I think I identified. I think I saw. It was definitely some kind of a heron. I was a tricolored heron. Could that be?
Ooh.
Kind of flew in, landed on the dock. You know, watched it for a few minutes, and then it flew off.
Maybe I don't. I mean, there's been one in the entire region, and they're kind of unique looking. They're very skinny.
Yeah, this was skinny, smallish bird, and it had looked like it, you know, seeing from
you,
a distance.
You probably saw a green heron.
A green heron. Well, that was my first thought, but then when I looked up the picture, I didn't think it looked like a green heron, but maybe it was. That would probably make more sense.
They're a little chunkier. They're smaller, chunkier necked. Tricolored herons, genuine rarity around here. There's been one at Forest Beach in Chatham. Mm-hmm. I think we'll probably talk about Forest Beach later. Hopefully it's just been blowing up with interesting birds, but that's been one of them. And they have kind of a white belly. They're different than the other herons and egrets in their pattern, but very skinny.
Long, skinny
neck. Even, I mean, herons and egrets have skinny necks anyway, but they have an especially skinny.
I guess I'd have to see one, because this one had a skinny neck, but, you know, who knows? Jenny's saying maybe a black-crowned night heron?
Well, they're pretty stocky, and usually you're seeing young ones this time of year, but maybe.
Yeah.
And they're more nocturnal, but it's certainly possible.
Yeah. It's fun to kind of try to figure out what you're looking at out there. And then, you know, on Sunday we took a walk on Chappaquoit Beach, and all those little sandpipers, I don't know what they are, but they are so darn cute.
Yeah, they are.
And I wonder why we don't see them on more, why do I always see them on that beach, but not necessarily on other Falmouth beaches?
I don't know. They're responding to food sources and maybe disturbance to some extent, but it's probably mostly about food and the tides in terms of where you see them. You know, their sandpipers are probing for little things in the sediment, small polychaete worms and other invertebrates that are in the sediment. You know, they pick some things off the sediment. But sandpipers are very tactile. Their bills are very sensitive. They have lots of little nerve endings in there, which they learned relatively recently in terms of bird research, I don't know, last 20 or 30 years. And so they can feel tiny, tiny little pressure differences in the sediment, especially the ones with really long bills like dowitchers. They've got that bill down in the sediment, you know, feeling for a little movement of a worm or little pressure difference from a burrow of a worm or something like that.
Well, they're finding something for sure.
So, they're finding food there. And they're probably semi-palmated sandpipers and sanderlings, I would guess.
Yeah, I don't know.
A lot of semi-palmated plovers
around,
too.
I'm still figuring that out.
I know.
It takes a while to learn.
Identifying the
stuff
small sandpipers is considered sort of more like intermediate to advanced birding. But with practice, you can do it.
I saw the laughing gull, and I was just looking up some things on laughing gulls, and I found this little interesting tidbit. The oldest known laughing gull was at least 22 years old when it was killed in Maine in 2009. It had been banded in Maine in 1987. So it was at least 22. That's amazing.
Well, yeah, that's typical for seabirds. Terns are the same way. You might be 25-year-old terns out there.
Who knew? You did.
Yeah. That's why I'm here.
Yeah.
So there are terns out there that are older than the research texts that are studying them.
Wow. Yeah. That's amazing. All right, so you mentioned Chatham, and we're seeing some interesting birds in Chatham. Like what?
Yeah. So there's a beach in Chatham, Forest Beach, that is sort of under the radar. It's probably not birded as much as it should be. It's a nice little barrier beach, a nice, well-kept secret. Not anymore. But it's one of those things where a rare bird turns up and then suddenly everybody discovers Forest Beach. You know, I ran into some birders there who birded the Outer Cape for a long time, and they're like, we've never been here. But it's a little barrier beach with a nice marsh behind it and a creek. It's on Nantucket Sound. And, you know, it, proximity-wise, it's not that far from, like, Monomoy. And so it's part of that complex of sites that always have good birds, which just attract a lot of attention from migrating seabirds and shorebirds this time of year. And somebody found an American avocet. I'm sorry, I can't remember who found it. But this is a pretty spectacular shorebird. Very tall. You know, you think of a greater yellowlegs, which is a tall, lanky shorebird that's common in marshes this time of year, but it's much bigger than that, longer legs, and this crazy bill that is just bent up at the end, really unique bill within the bird world, and apparently they use that, they kind of sweep it back and forth on mud flats and, you know, scoop up these little invertebrates on the surface, but a genuinely rare bird around here. They're white with black and white on the wings. And breeding plumage, they're cool looking. I used the term rusty mustard to describe the color of their head. I thought I coined that, but I looked it up and it was a thing in clothes. But once that was there, it was in eBird and people started going there. And then all these other things started turning up, which is what happens when a rare bird shows up and then you get more eyeballs on a location and suddenly other interesting birds are turning up there. And so like three marbled godwits, which is another spectacular shorebird that's pretty uncommon. A big mottled cinnamon-colored sandpiper, big long up-curved bill, big long legs, and they might have come from the same place. The godwits and the avocet, they breed. These are birds that breed in the interior west, which is people probably think of shorebirds as coastal or Arctic tundra or whatever. Yeah. But there's a suite of shorebirds that nests in, you know, like prairie potholes and Great Salt Lake, you know, places like that in kind of arid regions of the interior west or the prairie region, and marbled godwits and avocets are among them. And so who knows, they might have hitched the same ride, you know, got the same bad directions or something, because they're not supposed to be here.
Yeah.
I mentioned the tricolored heron was there, used to be called the Louisiana heron, the old bird books. Little blue heron, glossy ibises have been there consistently for some reason, and that's just not a bird you run into really anywhere on the Cape.
So sort of a hot spot at the moment.
Yes, it's absolutely become a hot spot. And it's, you know, now it's after Labor Day and you don't have to pay or anything like that, so you can go birding there. The back trail's a little treacherous, a lot of poison ivy, but there's this back trail that goes down to, you know, the end and where you can see the... And there's some other vantage points, too, off of roads near there, but... it's just been a nice kind of one-stop shopping for your interesting rarities of late. The other thing that's been turning up for some reason is lark sparrows. And this is a beautiful big sparrow that is not normally around. They don't breed here. It's one of those. They're not supposed to be here, but a couple turn up every fall. But it just seems like an unusual number, like almost a fallout event of lark sparrow. So keep an eye out for like a big sparrow with a really kind of harlequin head pattern, kind of chestnut and white and black stripes on the head. It's a very different looking sparrow than any of ours. Plain breast, good size. A couple have turned up in Truro and Provincetown and West Dennis Beach, I think, had one, or Seagull Beach, one of those beaches. So there might be others around, so keep an eye out. They don't tend to turn up at feeders. I don't think
of them
as
likely to see
one
them
of those
at the
sparrows
beach,
that would be scratching under your feeder with a towhee or a song sparrow. But maybe out where other migrants might be, you know, or with flocks of chipping sparrows or something in a field or,
And what about Race Point? Usually Race Point is a good spot. Are we seeing anything out there?
Yeah, it's been good. And so we just had that storm, right? And birders get very excited about tropical storms. When, you know, because of the potential of them bringing interesting things here, right? So they could pick up things from the Caribbean Basin or off of the Gulf Stream, off of Hatteras, where there's interesting birds that we would not normally see here, and definitely not from shore. These are birds that are of warm water, that are out where the Gulf Stream is, which is very far offshore when you get up here. And sometimes these things get entrained in a storm like that, depending on how they set up and how the winds work. And in extreme examples, hurricanes and things that come through here, they can bring tropical seabirds from, you know, that would typically nest down by Cuba to lakes in the Berkshires. That's wow. happened before. So really interesting situations can arise when you get birdwise, when you get these tropical storms. And so people were excited, but just the way this storm worked, it didn't really do much. I'm not aware of any kind of tropical storm birds that came out of this. There was some of the typical things like you would expect during a fall storm, where you would go to Sandy Neck in Barnstable and then First Encounter in East Ham. They weren't super productive, but there were some Leach's storm petrels, which is a pretty uncommon seabird. Typically, mm-hmm. we see Wilson's storm petrels, but this is a different one that you might expect during a storm like this, and there were a few of those. I think they had some at Race Point, too. But there are always good birds at Race Point, especially mm-hmm. this time of year. It's just a great place to see shorebird migration, seabird migration, some shorebirds, too. All four species of shearwaters from land, mm-hmm. you know, which is not something you can do most parts of the world. Right. I mean, shearwaters are boat birds. Mm-hmm. You see shearwaters from a boat. And at Race Point, you see them from the beach and some other parts of the Cape, too. So a lot of terns have mm-hmm. been migrating past Race Point, thousands and thousands of common terns, hundreds of roseate terns, which is a federally endangered species that some people come to this area to see.
Right.
We're a really important area for terns, especially that Provincetown area and then some of the barrier beaches on the east side of the Cape here. Terns come here from Nova Scotia to Long Island. So terns that bred in colonies between Nova Scotia and Long Island converge on Cape Cod. We're a very important place regionally for common and roseate terns. We know this through banding studies where you can tell where these different birds came from. And so people were seeing thousands of terns flying by Race Point, among other things. And that's typical this time of year. You can go to like Hatches Harbor, which is if you walk down Race Point Beach down to the actual race and keep going. And there are big flocks of terns staging there and always the potential for interesting things to be there.
Yeah. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. It's Bird News This Morning with Mark Faraday, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join the conversation. You have a bird question or a story to share with us. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Eileen sent us a photo of a laughing gull, and she says, I was thinking that a small group had agreed to meet for brunch, and this was the first one to arrive. Looks like he or she is stomping its foot with impatience. She says, Cockle Cove isn't far from Forest Beach and also is backed by an active marsh. So another spot.
Yeah, there's lots of little spots. And so I always encourage people to just find kind of their local patch. I mean, there's lots of little out-of-the-way places that the birders don't necessarily get to, you know, little ponds and marshy spots and little beaches with marshes behind them. And all of them could produce something, you know, the ordinary birds are great. Just looking at the ordinary birds mm-hmm. is great. But then it could produce something totally wacky. That, yeah. You know, first record for the Cape or the state or whatever. You never know where they're going to turn up.
So when, in the break, you were checking this eBird app. Tell us, what is that?
Oh, eBird. So, you know, we've talked about it before, and it's really revolutionized birding, and it's grown exponentially in terms of how many people use it. It's a Cornell Lab of Ornithology project that's, boy, I don't know, going on 20 years old now, at 15-something. And it's just become absolutely indispensable for birders. And it's where you learn about rare birds. It's where you learn about common birds and where they are and who's seeing them and where they're seeing them. It's a global database of basically real-time birdwatcher data.
Hmm.
And it's lots of rich content. I mean, you can embed the photos you took that day into the checklist so other people can say, oh, yeah, they really did see that. This is the era of photos or it didn't happen.
Yeah.
and so you can embed those right in the checklist, and everything is like clickable, and you can look at species accounts of the birds, and you can look up, where in the world would I find this species? And it brings up a map of everywhere where people have seen that species.
Oh, wow.
Or where in Barnstable County can I find a ringneck duck? What time of year? You can answer all of those questions with eBird. You don't even need to have an account to do that kind of stuff. But having an account allows you to keep track of your sightings. And a lot of us are varying degrees of obsessive about keeping track of what we're seeing, and that's good data-wise, right?
Yeah.
That's good for the database. And it's not just for fun. It's not just for the tennis-shoed and binoculared birdwatcher set. Researchers are using this data for serious peer-reviewed studies looking at climate change and changing bird distributions and things like that. So it's a way to contribute to science,
like
while
citizen science,
just citizen science, while, you know, just engage in your favorite hobby. Get you know, I do it in my yard. I have an eBird list going. Sometimes I have to see something interesting to trigger me to start a list. You know, I don't just go out, you know, start one every morning for the song sparrows and things that are out there. But if I get something interesting, like, oh, I haven't had a towhee in a while, I'll start a checklist. But again, all of that goes into the database. And it is vetted. There are saintly volunteer reviewers who, you know, they have to put up with people being like, what do you mean I didn't see that what I saw? I saw what I saw.
Yeah.
You know, so they.
But if you have a picture.
People don't like being, right, photos or it didn't happen.
Yeah.
but sometimes a description works,
yeah,
like in the olden days. And so they are, for certain things that trip the filters because it was too many of a given, you're reporting too many of something that's not very common, or you're reporting something that shouldn't be there that time of year, or it's just rare for that region. It will trip a filter, and then a person has to, you will either follow up with you or give it the okay. So there are data vetting mechanisms in place. It's not just a free-for-all.
Yeah.
I mean, there's certainly crap data in there because people are people and they're misidentifying things below the level of the filters, you know, people just getting started and that kind of thing. But overall, it's such a big data set. I think it's pretty robust to that kind of stuff and pretty useful for research. But I use it pretty much every day. And so I was looking in the break. I was, you know, I was kind of like winging it, as it were, talking about what they were seeing at Race Point. And then I brought up this checklist where birders reported seeing a couple of pectoral sandpipers, which is really nice, and they included a beautiful photo, this gorgeous juvenile pectoral sandpiper. They had 17 parasitic Jaegers, black-legged kittiwakes, 500 laughing gulls, a couple of lesser blackback gulls is rare, 4 black terns, which is nice, 3,600 common terns, 200 roseate terns. Gives you an idea of what a day at Race Point can be like. Wilson storm petrels, 250. All 4 species of shearwater, 2,200 northern gannets. I mean, it's an awesome place. And this was after the storm, so maybe there was a little bit more activity than usual, but that's that can be typical this time of year for that spot.
Catherine in Kituit writes, "Hi, the hummingbirds' visits are becoming less frequent. Are they getting ready to leave the area?"
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they have places to be, and it's not here. And this leads into the common thing. When do I have to take my feeders down so they know to leave? They know to leave. I don't take my feeders down. And I had a male, which I don't usually see, but in my place in Harwich, I had this male who was holding court at the end of the summer up until, you know, a few days ago. And he would chase all the younger ones away when they would come into this one feeder. I had 4 total, pretty regular every day. But this one male was really sort of abusive towards the other ones. And so it was very obvious when he left because all of a sudden the young ones or females or immatures, whatever they were able to feed in peace. And so he left.
The bully is gone.
Right. Yeah. And the young ones probably stick around a little bit longer. But by mid-September, they go.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter if your feeder's still out or if there's some flowers still blooming. I mean, if you think about it, you know, a lot of warblers have migrated. There aren't no insects. I mean, they don't wait till there's zero food to migrate. They migrate when they migrate, and it's governed by, you know, day length and these other forces. It's not about when your plate is clean, you fly south.
But this would be a good time to keep an eye on the hummingbird feeders because sometimes we do get hummingbirds that aren't normally seen around.
Absolutely.
Here.
Yeah. Not so much in September for some reason.
But October.
But maybe it's because we still have so many ruby-throateds that people don't notice the rare ones as much. But after mid-September, I'd say by October 1st, if you're seeing a hummingbird, there's a pretty good chance that it's something rare. And then let me know.
Take a picture.
Yeah. Sue Finnegan, we have one hummingbird bander, really, this side of the Berkshires or this side of, you know, Western Mass. There are only two, I think, in the whole state, people licensed to band hummingbirds. It's pretty specialized because they're so...
Yeah, they're small.
They're so widow.
Yeah.
and Sue Finnegan is that person on the Cape. We're lucky to have her and Brewster. And she's, you know, responded to a lot of these, and she's able to determine the species, which is good for us who are interested in bird records and getting things right. And sometimes these birds stay for quite a while into the cold months, which is interesting. It always surprises people, but... hummingbirds are not made of glass. They're pretty common in some pretty cold parts of the New World here. They only occur in this hemisphere. They're not in Europe or Asia or Africa. But they occur in some pretty high elevation, pretty cool places. They breed in southern, you know, coastal Alaska. And so they're not that intolerant of cold as long as they're getting food. And they can survive here. They've survived here into February. If they're getting food, you know, supplemental food, they couldn't, in the wild, they wouldn't. Right. But.
All right, let's talk to Genevieve, who's calling from Oak Bluffs. Good morning.
Good morning. I have two quick questions,
sure.
If I may.
Yes.
The first one, I saw odd behavior at my feeder. They look like sparrows, and I could, you know, sort of typical sparrow color, but they were just at the feeder, not eating, and one was ruffling his feathers, almost like it looked like a mating kind of dance. And not eating at all. And then other birds would come and flock around that bird, and it was very odd behavior.
That is odd behavior.
Yeah,
I don't know. They looked like sparrows. Are you familiar with, I don't know, they could have been sparrows, they could have been house finches. I've seen a surprising number of what seems to me like late broods of things like chipping sparrows. At the very end of the summer, like very recently fledged juveniles of song sparrows and chipping sparrows that have been around the last week or two. And there's a fledgling song sparrow in my yard every day right now, calling, being fed by the adults, which is nice because song sparrows often get parasitized by cowbirds. I feel like I mostly see song sparrows feeding cowbird, brown-headed cowbird chicks. So, I mean, it could have been a recently fledged young that's just doing the stupid things that kids do. Ruffling feathers could have been, you know, was it in the bird bath? I don't know. I don't know what.
Yeah.
Sometimes we get our feathers ruffled. Yeah. It happens.
What was the other question?
The other one was, I saw something I've never seen before. It was diminishing light at the bird bath. And this looked like the shape of a sparrow. He had a sort of a grayish belly and maybe black cheek streaks. But when he turned around, and he was just over the bath. He never took a bath. And when he turned around, I saw yellow tail feathers that almost looked like, you know, when a moth has eyes on it, it almost looked like it was kind of eyes scaring predators away, that kind of thing. I mean, they're bright yellow. I thought they were tail feathers, and I only saw them when he turned around. And I thought maybe the closest thing I could see was a pine siskin. Perhaps?
Probably not. They come through later. Last year was a good year for them. They were here during the winter. They would probably start migrating later in the month or October, if at all, if we see them. Not a goldfinch? I mean, goldfinch is one of the most common birds, probably top five most common birds on Cape Cod pretty much year-round.
I have a lot of goldfinches, and it wasn't yellow anywhere else. It was black and white and gray belly. And then when it turned around, just these streaks, like just one yellow, bright yellow feathers. Not, you know, just like one on each side of the tail.
Mm-hmm. How
very
big?
Strange.
But you're saying it was little? It was itty bitty like a goldfinch?
Yeah. Maybe more sparrow size.
Oh, well, a siskin would be the size of a goldfinch. They're pretty tiny.
Okay.
That's a tough one.
Yeah. I'll have to think about it. It'll come to me after the show, I'm sure.
Yeah, well, it's also, too, with the light of the day, you know, can change the reflection can change the color. Yeah, thanks, Genevieve, for the phone call. Appreciate your questions. All right, Peter is giving us a call from South Yarmouth. Hi, Peter.
Hello, good morning. I have observation about turkeys and some questions.
Sure.
They like to visit our backyard on a regular basis, and they like to scratch away the salt marsh hay, which I have surrounding our fruit trees, and they also like to scratch on our compost pile. But I wondered when the young were born, because I see young with them now, and when the young depart, the adults, and go out on their own, things like that about turkeys.
Yeah, next year. So a lot of people are noticing, kind of like I was talking about with the sparrows, this all of a sudden a late summer flush of turkey chicks. You know, you're seeing little ones all of a sudden that you haven't seen in a while. So a second brood, or, you know, depending on the female, I don't know if they would have three, second brood, or, you know, their attempts during the rest of the spring and summer were failing, and then they finally had a successful brood because the foxes are eating other things or whatever. So yeah, there's a lot, and they have a really long breeding season, and then they tend to flock up, and so you'll get multiple broods that will come together. And you've probably seen these big flocks in the, especially in the fall and winter, and those are made up of multiple broods where they kind of all stay together. And then I honestly don't know what happens. They break up. I can't figure out the flocks even at Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary where I work. I mean, you know, you see eight pretty routinely, and then all of a sudden there's 12, and then there's 15, and then there's four. And I don't know what goes on or how these flocks develop and break apart, but they do stay together, and they tend to get into bigger groups fall into the winter.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right, Peter, thanks for the phone call. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. And Mary writes, I've noticed that birds fly away when they notice my binoculars at close distance, about 10 to 15 feet, especially if I'm looking from several feet inside my kitchen bay window. Are they seeing light reflected from the lenses that looks like eyes? Is there anything I can do to the lenses to make them less reflective?
Oh, that's interesting. The good binoculars tend to have anti-reflective coatings. I don't know. Don't know what kind. Mm-hmm. Did she say what kind?
She didn't say what kind. No. But could it also be just the movement of?
Yeah,
you
the
know,
movement. Yeah,
up,
yeah. Right. If you're there enough, they sort of get used to it. Like at the sanctuary, we have these feeder windows, and the birds know there's movement on the inside of the windows because there's always people in there. Yeah, just try to be stealthy and be cognizant of lights, like turn off your inside lights. If you try to darken the inside, you'll be less obvious to the birds outside where it's brighter. Mm-hmm. I know when I'm like, if I want to photograph something at my feeder from inside my house, I turn off my kitchen lights. The first thing I do, get all the lights off. I don't know. The anti-reflective coatings tend to come with binoculars or not, and I don't know about anything you can add to that, or whether I doubt that would make much difference, frankly.
You're listening to The Point. It's Bird News with Mark Faraday, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. 866-999-4626 is our number. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Okay, so since we went on the break, Mary wrote back her binoculars are Bushnell 10x42 and Pentax 7x20 binoculars. So those are good binoculars, right?
They might be, yeah. Yeah, no, yeah. Both of those companies binoculars.
All right, so what are the swarms of gulls doing over the beaches and marshes? What's going on? Is it
swarming gulls, yeah. So this is a question I've gotten a few times, and it's a classic phenomenon this time of year. It seems to especially be at barrier beaches where you just see these flocks of gulls and sometimes terns. The terns were getting in the mix when I was at Forest Beach. It just looks strange, right? You think of gulls, they feed in the water. They sit on the beach or they feed in the water, or they're at the dump or the McDonald's parking lot. So why are they swarming around like swallows? It just looks strange. And somebody who asked me this question was like, it looked like they were waiting for someone to make the first move to go down and feed on clams or something. But they're fly catching. And so especially laughing gulls and ring-billed gulls, they take advantage of something that happens this time of year, which is flying ants. And so ant colonies this time of year, I should know the species, but they send out what is in entomological terms, winged alates, A-L-A-T-E-S. And it's just a winged form of the ants that then go forth and attempt to start new colonies. And they swarm. And so this is a food resource. It's a food resource for people in some parts of the world, like in Africa, when termites do it. But anyway, the gulls are swarming around like swallows, and they're fly-catching. It was interesting to see common terns doing it as well. And you think of them as exclusively fish eaters, like diving for fish. That's what terns do, and they do it all the time. But they were taking advantage of that as well.
All right, what about the bald birds? You've been getting that question a bit lately.
Yeah.
I always thought that was a spring thing. Does
bald,
that happen now?
Bald birds are beautiful birds, Mindy. Don't forget it. So, yeah, so this is a molt thing, and this came up a bunch of times, either through questions to me or on social media, people were talking about it, where, you know, why is this cardinal bald? It's usually a cardinal or a blue jay that brings this up. And it's this perennial question, why is the cardinal bald? But this time of year, it usually is just molt. And so one of these pictures was on one of the Facebook groups, and you could see what are called pin feathers, which is when feathers grow in. Mm-hmm. They first break through the skin in this weird little sheath, like the thing on the end of a shoelace, which I forget what that's called. Somebody told me recently, and I've already forgotten it. But anyway, it's like that, and it breaks through the skin in this sheath, and that's called a pin feather, and then the feather breaks out, grows and then breaks out of that. And so you could see this cardinal was bald, and the skin turns black when it's exposed like that. And so this black-headed, bald, weird-looking cardinal, it's always a conversation starter.
Oh, yeah.
But you could see that the feathers were growing back, and so this was a molt thing. But sometimes they don't grow back, and that's the weirder thing. But this time of year, birds are molting. An adult bird will molt every feather on them. Wing flight feathers, tail feathers, body feathers, sometime over some time period between now and the winter. And they're on different schedules. Some birds molt during migration. Some birds molt when they get to the wintering grounds in Central or South America. Some birds fly somewhere to molt and then molt everything and then migrate. You know, so there's all these interesting different strategies. But the point is they're molting. And so adult birds look... they look like hell right now, frankly. You know, as I always say, they've just raised their kids, and they're done.
They're tired.
They don't look good, and so they need, you know, they go to a spa somewhere and molt all their feathers, and then by the time it's winter, they look good again.
They were ready. Aglet. Yeah. Aglet is what the
aglet. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, there you
Very
go.
Good.
Okay, thank you, Google.
Oh, I was going to say, did you think of that, or did you Google that?
I did not. Joan is giving us a call from East Harwich. Hi, Joan.
Good morning. On Father's Day, I had father show up at my peanut butter feeder. It was the male red-bellied woodpecker, the hairy woodpecker, and the downy woodpecker. Didn't see any females until around the 4th of July, and then a female flicker showed up with two of her babies. So Father's Day was very busy with the fathers, with their kids. And now I've got a weird one about the jelly dish. The male red-bellied woodpecker came to the jelly dish back in the spring for a couple of weeks and then stopped. And now I've got the cardinal family, mama, papa, and daughter. They brought the baby and showed the baby the dish, and now the baby comes on its own. And the top of it all was the hummingbird. I had a hummingbird, and it wasn't a one-time deal. The hummer showed up for a couple of weeks sporadically on and off, and it would land on the jelly dish, and it would actually be eating something. What would it be eating?
The sugary water that forms if, you know, it's sugary. And so, yeah, I think they're probably just lapping up some of the sugary water. So let me get this straight. You feed peanut butter and jelly. Why don't you just leave a loaf of bread out? The birds can make themselves a sandwich. Jeez.
No, the peanut butter is in separate feeder.
All right.
Well. But also the hummer, after it went to the jelly dish, it would fly up a couple of feet over to the hummingbird feeder, and then it would drink the hummingbird nectar.
Yeah.
Yeah, so lots of things visit the hummingbird feeders just for a little drink or, you know, a little sweet tooth. Woodpeckers is a classic thing. Somebody sent me a photo recently of a downy woodpecker on their hummingbird feeder, and they're like, what is this? And they were assuming it was
drink.
A sapsucker, I think, because of the sugar.
The oriole and the chickadee comes to the hummingbird feeder.
Yeah, for sure.
Besides the hummer.
Do you still have any orioles?
I had none after last Wednesday until yesterday afternoon, and then I had a pair, a male and a female.
Yeah, so they're in full transient mode now. So your neighborhood ones probably left, and then you might not have any for a week, and then maybe you get a couple. And so they'll be kind of here and there, coming and going probably through October. They're definitely on the move.
Hummer. Yeah,
The Hummers were gone for a couple of days, and then a male Hummer came through on Sunday, and then yesterday afternoon late, either a juvenile or a female came through.
Yep. Yeah, everything's on the move.
All right, Joan, thanks for the update. We appreciate it. We have an email here from MB who says, another app from the lab of O gave me a fun experience a few days ago. At my house, I heard what I thought might be a wren, so I went to Merlin on my iPad and played the bird call to remind myself of it. Immediately, two wrens turned up on my deck rail and sat there looking for the new wren in the area. It was very cute to watch them carefully, and one even broke into song and had a duet with my iPad.
Oh, that's funny. Carolina wrens, I assume. Yeah.
Yeah, that's so funny.
Yeah, use that power wisely. Yeah. And Merlin, I mean, we could easily do a whole show and then some about all the apps and something I do workshops on. But it's changed things, and there are such good ones. And Merlin is one I always recommend for really any experience level. It's great for beginners because it can walk you through an identification of something you saw in your yard, answer a few questions. It's free, for one thing.
I want to check that out. Yeah.
It's another Cornell Lab of Ornithology. Mm-hmm. It draws on the eBird database, but it has photo identification. So if you get a decent photo of the bird in there, it'll suggest four or five possibilities. But it also, it's just a good overall birding app where you have range maps, audio, pictures, and they have all these packs. Like, it works in Costa Rica now, in Panama. It's starting to work in Colombia, which has 1,800 species of birds. So it's becoming like a free, all-you-need app for birding in the new world. And, well, not even. It's Europe. There's Eastern and Western Europe packs now. I mean, they're really taking over the world. And it's still free.
Yeah, that's great.
So it's really a tremendous app. And even for those countries, you're getting the same thing. Usually range maps, they're adding content all the time. But songs and calls, it's really, really valuable.
Yeah. So Janet sent us a note of in a picture, a really nice picture. She's a black gray bird with yellow tail feathers. Could it have been a juvenile cedar waxwing?
Oh, interesting.
Maybe, right?
Well, she didn't say the tip of it. That would have tipped me off, if you will.
Yes, but maybe that's what...
That wasn't very good. But the cedar waxwing, and so this may not be very compelling radio, you and I looking at a photo together silently. someone sent in this very nice photo of a juvenile cedar waxwing, which basically looks like a cedar waxwing, but the crest is kind of smaller and more slicked back, and there's kind of splotchy and almost streaky looking.
That might have been what Genevieve might have been, that's what she might have been looking
maybe,
at.
But she was saying things that I wasn't really following, like it looked like eyes to scare predators. I mean, the tip of the tail being pure yellow is a pretty distinctive thing.
Right.
So who knows?
Right. All right. So now Lee writes, I still have my cut orange grape jelly feeder up, and this morning a hummingbird was there, not for long before it flew off, so I didn't get a good look at it. It was the first time that I saw it at the feeder, but I've seen them in my butterfly garden over the summer. There you go.
Yeah. They're still around, and they'll be coming through. And you can pretty much assume that they're ruby-throated hummingbirds through the end of the month. Mm-hmm. But always be vigilant. If you see a lot of orangey color, like a rusty color on the sides or at the base of the tail or a little bit on the back, that's going to be one of the interesting ones, like a rufous hummingbird or rare cases an Allen's or one of the other hummingbirds from out west that go the wrong way. And instead of flying to Arizona or western Mexico, where they should be for the winter, for some reason they end up on Cape Cod. It happens every year. Mm-hmm. So keep an eye out.
All right. Yeah. Richard's calling from Oak Bluffs. Good morning, Richard.
Hi, it's Dick Johnson over on the vineyard. Not really looking for identification, but I saw an interesting dove the other day, and I wonder if anybody else has seen anything around. I was down at near Tisbury Great Pond at One Point Wildlife Refuge and saw a small chunky dove much smaller than a mourning dove. It had a bluish gray back of the head and nape. I didn't have my good binoculars with me, so I couldn't really see the breast or the front. And when it flew, I couldn't follow it. So I don't even know if I had a square tail or a notch tail, but I'm just wondering if anybody else sees it. I'd sure love to know what it was.
All right, so put the word out.
Yeah. How confident are you about the size? Size of a lone bird can be tough. A small dove would be really rare. The things, the doves that are smaller than mourning doves, pretty much never show up.
That's why I was very curious. No, it's much, much smaller. I'm confident it was much smaller than a mourning dove. Didn't have a long tail. Definitely had a short tail. You know, I've seen a variety of ground doves in Arizona and the Caribbean. More that size, more like a ground dove.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, common ground dove is that would be a kind of a monumental thing that people would be coming to see, but... hope that turns up again.
I feel bad that I didn't get it out on the Vineyard Bird Alert, so somebody could have gone down yesterday.
Yeah, who knows?
But I just want to put it out there.
Okay, Rick, if we hear, we'll let you know. We know how to contact you. Thanks, Rick, for the phone call. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
All right, so last month we talked about monarch butterflies, and you know, somebody sent us in, and I'm sure you have seen it since the last month when we did the show, this sort of homemade... cheesecloth sort of enclosure that she put over her milkweed, and then wondered, "Hey, will that work?"
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. As long as you're just, I don't know. I mean, it's keeping a lot of sunlight out. I would try to do something that's letting a little more light. I don't know. I mean, I'm just sort of right.
Well, you know,
I haven't experimented with it.
We had our monarch butterfly, and of course it got released while I was out of town, so I didn't get to see it.
Oh, really?
But, you know, we were in the garden this weekend, and we found like four more.
Oh, really?
From very different, I mean, with the little teeny tiny one up to the one that I was like, oh my gosh, this one's going to be going up to do its...
Interesting. I'm in a bit of a lull where I was seeing tons and they eclosed and flew away, and I have not been finding the caterpillars the last week and a half or something like that, either at work or at my house, where I had this one swamp milkweed. Mm-hmm. And again, I feel like I can't say it often enough. Swamp milkweed, great, easy garden plant that monarchs love to lay their eggs on, maybe even more than common. Forget about common milkweed.
Yeah.
People latch onto that, and it's not a good garden plant. I don't think it does well on the Cape. It looks like hell at the end of the summer. Just put some swamp milkweed, Asclepias incarnata, in your garden. It's
easy. Butterfly weed, too. That's
the butterfly weed is
and
also
that's where
a milkweed.
We found one of them on the butterfly weed. Yeah,
they're all in the genus Asclepias. And so, yes, butterfly weed or orange milkweed is another name for it. They love that as well. They definitely were using both species at the sanctuary this year. In my yard, for some reason, they didn't use any of the butterfly weed. I have a couple varieties, one swamp milkweed plant, one mature plant, was just absolutely pumping out monarch caterpillars.
Really?
And I know of three chrysalises, and two of them were successful. And we got to see them emerge, which was really cool.
So
it was a great year for monarchs. It was fun. And it helped me with my pollinator garden at the sanctuary in Wellfleet there because, you know, it's sort of peaking the last few weeks. And you just walk into it and like a monarch would just like hit you in the face. So visitors were like, wow, look at this thing. And I couldn't have paid them to do any better.
Yeah. Well, I do have the common milkweed and I planted it in the sort of the back of the gardens because, you know, it, as you say, it doesn't look so great towards the end of the summer. But of course, it's gone crazy. I have so much of it now I have to pull it out.
Right. Yeah. So I should mention something. If you're managing for monarchs, you can avoid that they look like hell at the end of the summer thing by mowing it early in the summer, or late spring. You can look up the guidelines, but mow it in June or something like that, and you'll have smaller, fresh ones that they can use this time of year.
Mark Faraday, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. As always, thank you, Mark.
See you next time.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.